Welcome to the Jerry Robinson Radio Show, where we spend an hour every week confronting the lies of the age. With Jerry Robinson, the Chief Economic Strategist for Makers Group Financial and the founder and director of Jerry Robinson Ministries International, a Christian nonprofit organization dedicated to challenging believers to think and thinkers to believe. As a trained economist and ordained Christian minister, Jerry is the key economic speaker at the Stealing the Mind Bible Conferences, a columnist for WorldNet Daily, and the author of the best-selling book, Bankruptcy of Our Nation. And now your host, Jerry Robinson.
Well, welcome to the Jerry Robinson Show. So glad to have you here. U.S. home sales jump in April to five-month highs as durable orders are up, signaling to investors that the U.S. may be weathering the euro debt crisis better than expected. But will the U.S. be able to weather its own debt crisis? Moody's reiterates its warning about the risk to America's AAA credit rating. Meanwhile, the U.S. unemployment rate continues to edge higher as private pay shrinks to historic lows as government payouts rise. Meanwhile, in the eurozone, the crisis continues to force Europe into a new era of government spending cuts as the IMF raises fresh concerns about the Spanish economy and more austerity measures are implemented amid continued public protests. The mounting pressure on the euro becomes a major factor leading to new record sales of gold and silver in the month of May. We're gonna discuss many of these different topics here on the Jerry Robinson Show. So glad that you're here. Well, welcome once again to a radio show that's intentionally designed to educate, equip, and empower you, the listener, on the important geopolitical, economic, and cultural trends that are literally reshaping our world each and every day. We have a great show planned for you this week, and to get things kicked off right, I'll hand things over to my co-host, Jay Blevins. Jay?
Hey, thanks, Jerry. As always, it's a pleasure and an honor to be here with you on the Jerry Robinson Radio Show. We have an absolutely fantastic show for you this week. Our special guest interview is Daniel Ammerman, a financial futurist, author, speaker, and consultant with over 20 years of financial industry experience. Daniel will be talking to us today about how the U.S. employment may be hammered by the euro plunge. Also, Jerry's commentary this week is on the U.S. national debt crisis. And, of course, we have this week's recurring segments, the weekly wrap, the road to the one world currency, and your listener question of the week. So without further ado, let's go ahead and kick it off with the weekly wrap. Welcome to the Weekly Wrap, where each week we take a look at the most pressing economic and geopolitical news from around the globe. This week's first story comes from the Breitbart.com, dated May 25th, 2010. Europe's woes unlikely to spur recession. The European debt crisis isn't likely to throw the global economy back into a recession, a Federal Reserve official said Tuesday. The turmoil will probably fall short of becoming a worldwide recessionary shock, said James Buller, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, in a speech delivered in London. In the past, when countries defaulted on their debt, the episodes generated financial turmoil, but they didn't throw the world economy into a downturn, Bullard said. He cited Russia's default in 1998 as a case in point. Now, Jerry, is Mr. Bullard's assessment on this correct, or has the global economy become so intertwined that any country defaulting has dire international consequences?
Well, I mean, there's no doubt there's a whole lot of shaking going on right now in the eurozone. I mean, this week, Spain approved a 15 billion euro austerity package to help rein in that country's massive public deficit. It's going to cut public worker salaries by an average of about 5%. Additionally, Italy just recently approved 24 billion euros of austerity measures designed to reduce public sector pay, and will put a freeze on new recruitment. And already, Italian workers have taken to the streets in protest, kind of mimicking the old Greek protests that we've been seeing.
And even in Thailand now, too.
Yeah, and even in Thailand. I have to agree with Bullard when he states that this is not, basically he's implying that this is not the end of the world. You know, we are going to continue to see the effects of this financial overleverage, government debt, poor banking and monetary policies, and over-reliance upon consumer debt. We're going to continue to see the fallout of this, and we're going to continue to see cuts across the board throughout Europe, but I don't believe that the euro crisis is the crisis to end all crises. I mean, there's still much more ahead. The West is currently going through a period of time that is basically a long, slow death, financially speaking. You know, a quick drop off the cliff would be merciful. That would be nice if basically we could just, you know, end it, end the pain, it's all over. Basically, what has to happen is we have to sacrifice. We have to go through periods of time such as this where we have austerity. The beneficiaries of this, obviously, are going to be the East, China, India, many of the emerging nations. And so we're watching this. But a quick drop off the cliff would be merciful, as I mentioned, but it's not how economies have failed in the past. So we are going to see a slow demise. I don't think that we can point to anything and say the dollar is going to completely collapse tomorrow or it's going to collapse next year. We're going to see a continued slow march in this direction until we can finally get back to a place of fiscal responsibility, Jay.
So a slow, torturous death instead of an execution.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. All right, our second story this week comes from the BBC, dated May 24th, 2010. U.S. home sales jump in April to five-month high. Sales of previously owned U.S. homes rose by 7.6% in April to a five-month high of 5.77 million, according to the industry body, the National Association of Realtors. Much of this rise was prompted by a last-minute rush to buy before a special tax credit expired at the end of last month. The figure was up 23% on April 2009. The NAR's chief economist, Lawrence Yun, said the end of the tax credit may cause a dip in sales. Now, Jerry, does this signal a turnaround in the housing market, or is it just a bounce caused by the tax credit?
Well, there's some irony, Jay, in this story, because mortgage rates have recently hit some of the lowest numbers on record. And at the same time, simultaneously, home prices have fallen so dramatically in many areas around the country. So it seems like a perfect time to be buying a house when you consider low mortgage rates and of course, the falling prices around the country.
Definitely a buyer's market right at the moment.
Well, the April numbers should be understood within their context. You know, what drove these large sales numbers throughout April was almost exclusively the end of the federal tax credit that was being extended to first-time home buyers and even those who weren't even first-time home buyers. What many people don't know is that 33% or one out of three of the homes that were sold during this period across the nation were distressed homes. You know, many realtors and mortgage brokers that I know are now wondering what's going to happen to the demand for homes now that the government handouts are going to come to a close. Remember, just last week we were reporting that the number of foreclosures was breaking new records. One out of seven U.S. homeowners was either A, late paying for their mortgage, or B, were in the process of foreclosure. So the Federal Reserve, understanding these calamitous times, especially in the housing crisis and the delicate nature of it, are keeping rates low. The Feds are hoping to accomplish two things by keeping rates low. A, is when it, in relationship to the mortgage market. A, to drive higher demand for home buying, because you keep rates low and obviously it drives demand up.
Right.
But also to prevent the many Alt-A and Option ARM loans due to reset over the next 6 to 18 months from becoming a total catastrophe. Many of these loans that were sold, again, are going to reset and are going to cause many people pain. And so by keeping rates low, they can help protect that. And one thing's for sure, the housing market in the U.S. will remain a buyer's market for some time. The unknown factor, in my opinion, is how long cheap interest rates will entice credit-worthy borrowers to take the plunge. We're going to keep our eyes on it, Jay.
Absolutely. All right, our next story is from Commodity Online, dated May 25th, 2010. It says here, record sales for gold and silver bullion in May. Gold and silver bullion sales at the United States Mint have reached record levels in May 2010. With about a week left to go, more than 200,000 ounces of gold and more than 3 million ounces of silver have already been sold to the Mint's authorized purchaser network, CoinUpdate.com reported. It looks like the precious metals market is continuing its strong growth. Jerry, do you think this upward trend will continue, or is this another financial bubble getting ready to burst?
That's a great question. Many people are asking, many investors saying, you know, gosh, is now the right time to buy gold, to buy silver? You know, we've been talking about silver and gold in particular over the last several months, you know, obviously, because many people are wondering. In our latest issue of the Follow the Money, Follow the Money Quarterly, the newsletter we put out every quarter, we spent some time and pretty much devoted the issue to the topic of silver. And the record for highest monthly silver Eagle bullion coin sales took place way back in 1986, when over almost 4 million ounces were sold during that month. Now, that was the first full month that the silver bullion coins were available for sale. Now, the fact is that was a non-crisis month, and that demonstrates to me that the silver market still has a long way to go before peaking. Because if we had that many sales in a non-crisis month, we haven't even hit the threshold of seeing massive mania buying of gold and silver because people are scared. Think about it, Jay. There are so many reasons why gold and silver really have a lot of upward pressure on them. We have U.S. money printing, which many people are perceiving to be very problematic, and from an economic standpoint, it is.
Absolutely.
We have the European debt crisis, which is threatening, obviously, to damage the U.S. economy. We have China and India and their gold investment demand. Now, we have the rise of precious metals ETFs that are obviously having to secure precious metals in order to back up their ETFs, at least most of them.
Right.
And then, of
course, sure all of them are doing that.
Right. And then declining gold mining production. We're seeing, you know, production of gold in the mining sector obviously going down. So this is not to mention simply the rise in global investment demand in precious metals physically, you know, physical precious metals among investors. So, of course, there's going to be dips in prices. I mean, of course, silver is not going to go straight up. Nothing goes up in a straight line. But we're going to be in a long-term upward bull market for precious metals, I believe, for some time, Jay.
Absolutely. All right. And our final weekly wrap story this week comes to us from USAtoday.com. Private pay shrinks to historic lows as government payouts rise. Paychecks from private business shrank to their smallest share of personal income in U.S. history during the first quarter of this year, a USA Today analysis of government data finds. At the same time, government-provided benefits from Social Security, unemployment insurance, food stamps, and other programs rose to a record high during the first 3 months of 2010. Those records reflect a long-term trend accelerated by the recession and the federal stimulus program to counteract the downturn. The result is a major shift in the source of personal income from private wages to government programs. Now, Jerry, this trend is troubling on many, many levels. How can the federal government afford to keep increasing benefits if the pool of private income from which to draw taxes keeps shrinking?
That's the million-dollar question, Jay.
Multi-trillion-dollar question.
Yeah. Well, there's a very interesting chart that came along with the story that really just shocked me as I looked at it. I guess I haven't seen these numbers before, but there's a chart in this story from the Bureau of Economic Analysis that shows that government benefits rose about 5.8% from the first quarter of 2000 until now, into the first quarter of 2010. And if you look at this chart, you can see how dramatic that is. It went from 12.1% to 17.9%. Meanwhile, private wages over that same decade from the first quarter of 2000 to the first quarter of 2010 went down from 47.6% down to 41.9%. And so many people tend to think, oh, this is a recent thing. Oh, this is an Obama thing. Oh, this is a recent Democratic-controlled Congress thing. No, really, this is a very fiscally flawed thing. This is this is bad monetary policy coupled with bad fiscal policy coupled with deficit spending galore.
Basically, this is the ramifications of a Keynesian economics policy.
Yeah, it's basically Keynesian economics coming full circle. And so, once again, we have proof that our current recovery that people keep talking about is simply government infusions of cash and government spending that is not rooted in any real meaningful structural economic changes in our country. I mean, this recession has erased 8 million private jobs, 8 million. And we've been watching and monitoring how these things have affected private wages and government benefits. And obviously, you know, government benefits are skyrocketing. We see food stamps at all-time highs recently. You know, there's all kinds of problems with our entitlement obligations that we have going out several years. It's just a mess, Jay. And there's always a silver lining somewhere. And obviously, we talk many times on this program about the silver lining, and the silver lining obviously is, you know, having a plan, having a game plan, understanding that these things are basically reality, not denying the facts. Facts are very stubborn things. They're hard to change. So basically lining yourself up and seeing what these things are and then making a financial game plan for yourself to weather the storm, Jay.
Absolutely. All right. Coming up after this break, our special guest interview with Daniel Ammerman about the effect of the euro crisis on U.S. employment. You're listening to The Jerry Robinson Show. We'll be right back.
What are you going to do when hyperinflation hits? With gold and silver prices making new highs over the last several months, many investors are beginning to turn their attention to the precious metals markets. Gold and silver can play an important role in balancing your investment portfolio, as it has traditionally offered a hedge of protection against out-of-control inflation, which may be on the horizon in the United States. While Makers Group Financial does not sell physical gold and silver, we do recommend an excellent precious metals dealer. His name is Tom Cloud, and his prices are outstanding. It's where I buy my gold and silver. If you would like to learn more about purchasing gold and silver, please contact Tom Cloud at 800-247-2222. 2812. Tell them that Jerry Robinson from the Jerry Robinson Show sent you, and he will throw in free shipping and free insurance on your order. Again, Tom Cloud, 800-247-2812. Be prepared for when hyperinflation hits.
The United States of America is in a state of financial emergency. Today, America's deficits are hitting all-time highs, the global credit crisis continues to worsen, and the U.S. money supply is expanding at a record pace, triggering widespread fears of coming inflation. How did America reach this level of economic chaos, and what can you do to protect yourself and your finances? In this hard-hitting 60-minute live presentation, well-known economist and best-selling author Jerry Robinson explains the real truth behind the falling U.S. dollar. You will learn, from a historical and political perspective, what is really happening to the U.S. dollar, why the U.S. dollar is on the brink of collapse, how the fall of the U.S. dollar may be leading to a one-world currency, when to expect the U.S. dollar to completely lose its value, and finally, you will learn where to invest in order to protect your finances from the coming collapse of the U.S. dollar. You cannot afford to miss this important presentation on one of the most pressing topics of our day. Arm yourself with the powerful information you need to protect yourself in these uncertain times. Order your copy of Jerry Robinson's latest DVD, Death of the Dollar, today. Call 918-827-JRMI. That's 918-827-5764. Or go online at www.jrmi.org.
All right, welcome back to the Jerry Robinson Show. Our mission, educating, equipping, and empowering believers to think and thinkers to believe. Find us on the web at www.jrmi.org or call 918-827-5764. And now here's Jerry with this week's special guest interview.
Thanks, Jay. Well, our guest this week is Daniel Ammerman, a financial futurist, author, speaker, and consultant with over 20 years of financial industry experience. He's a chartered financial analyst, a CFA, holds an MBA and a BSBA degree in finance from the University of Missouri, and he also contributes articles to Financial Sense University on the web at financialsense.com. Daniel, welcome to the Jerry Robinson Show. Thanks for taking time to join us on the program today.
Well, thank you very much, Jay and Jerry. I sure appreciate the invitation.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Great to have you here. Any friend of Financial Sense is a friend of ours, and we really appreciate to have you on the program. In your article, you wrote a very intriguing article this week. It came out on the 24th, I believe. It was called U.S. Employment May Be Hammered by Euro Plunge. Kind of an interesting take, kind of focusing on how the Euro debt crisis may actually spill over and affect the U.S. unemployment rate. You talk about how some Europeans will be forced kicking and screaming into a state, and I love this phrase that you use, a state of accidental virtue. Explain to our audience, what do you mean by that phrase, accidental virtue?
Well, the both the United States and Europe have enormous problems, and we've known these problems have been coming for decades, and they have to do with governments making impossible promises. For politically popular reasons, we in the United States and Europe have made essentially mainly retirement but also health care promises that we know, if we look at the number of people that we have to pay and the amount that we've promised to pay them, that our economy simply can't handle that. And that's really what this sovereign debt crisis is about, is all the promises that have been made by governments around the world, not just Greece, not just in Europe, but also the United States and Japan, and so where we know they can't pay for them. But what we've been doing, we've been ignoring these problems and kind of parting away in the present. Well, hopefully, you know, they won't hit and so forth and so on. And what's happened is that Europe is getting hit first. Europe is taking it hard. And the euro is off 13% since the beginning of the year. Some people think it's off 30% or more. So Europe is getting hammered by this. And this is leading to a stronger dollar, and many people are saying that, oh gosh, stronger, that's got to be good for the United States. Well, it's really pretty devastating for us in many ways when you connect some of the dots that probably the media won't be thing for at least another 6 months or so, but it's fairly basic economics. And it's really good for the Europeans over the long term, even though painful in the short term. And another way of looking at this is that because the euro is dropping, that means the Europeans can't buy as much from other countries, can't consume as much. They're not going to have as many TVs. They're not going to have as much gas to put in the car and so forth and so on. And we look at that and we say, well, very painful. They're being forced to sacrifice. They're being forced to a state of virtue. And the problem with that is they get a benefit that goes with it. They get more and more jobs because Europe just became cheaper and cheaper to employ, even though they're consuming less and less. They're effectively ticking and screaming against their will, being forced to lower standards they can't pay for anymore, while more and more Europeans are likely to get jobs. The problem with that, if you're in the U.S. and if you think, gosh, I'm glad I'm not a European, is those jobs are going to be coming from us, top of the 8 million we've already lost.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and you say that in the short term, companies that employ European workers will gain a powerful profit advantage, but assuming the euro stays down, the real advantages will be seen in the medium to long term. Why do you think that the advantage will be even greater in the long term?
It all comes down to a really differential problem recognition. They've recognized it now. That means their cost of labor drops substantially relative to ours. And that leads to U.S. job losses in four different ways, and none of these are likely to come back quickly. Number one, U.S. or companies, and I use a phrasing, not so much U.S. companies or European companies, but companies who employ American workers or companies who employ European workers, because that's what really matters. A company may employ workers anywhere. But companies that employ American workers to make products to sell in Europe just took a 13% hit compared to European companies.
Wow.
And that 13% hit, if you look at operating margins, is huge.
Mm-hmm.
Afford to compete. And it's going to get much worse if the euro continues to fall and we hit these 25-30% declines that some people are talking about. So American workers who make products that are sold in Europe are going to start losing jobs. We live in a globalized world. And that same 13% differential, or 30%, which could be much worse, is going to apply to European products that are sold in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
You go to Walmart, you buy things and so forth. All of a sudden, the products the Europeans make with their own very highly educated and trained workforce, like the American workforce, picked up a 13% advantage.
Mm-hmm.
In 6 months, that could be a 30% advantage. That's American jobs that are lost right there.
Mm-hmm.
So this double hit is going to be hitting companies. And you got to remember that by their very nature, corporations aren't patriots. They're there to try to make as much money as they possibly can. And this is going to be inflicting damaging losses on companies that employ American workers. So instead of being driven out of business by other companies, what they're going to do is they're going to try to send those jobs overseas as fast as they can.
Mm-hmm.
Because if a company switches from American workers to European workers faster than it loses market share,
mm-hmm.
that's how it survives. But that process takes a little while to happen, and that's why we're not going to see the worst of the damage for some time, although contracts are already being renegotiated this week and lost because of what's going on with the changes in the pricing and so forth.
Mm.
And then the fourth factor is this is economic turmoil. This is trouble. This does adversely affect the European economy, and this does adversely affect the U.S. economy, so there's likely to be lost sales from that perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So we take all four of those factors together, and they're each going to take time to kind of filter into the system.
Mm-hmm.
All four of those are going to lead to U.S. job losses. But where things really get bad over the longer term, and I'm afraid this is going to be the case, is that it is highly advantageous for the U.S. government from some perspectives, and particularly the Federal Reserve, to have a strong dollar policy. You know, for instance, the government's heavily focused, as you were talking about in your lead-in there, on U.S. housing.
Mm-hmm.
And a key part of trying to get a recovery in U.S. housing is to have lower mortgage rates.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a couple reasons we have very low mortgage rates. One of them is the Federal Reserve did this massive $1.25 trillion intervention to create an entirely artificial market, where it essentially created $1.25 trillion out of thin air and used that to fund the U.S. mortgage market. Now, coming behind that was a strong dollar. Money's flowing into the U.S. from all around the world because the world created the euro, and that lowers our interest rates because more and more people are trying to buy our bonds and mortgage securities. So this short-term fix that's gone that the Federal Reserve and the government are very happy about, and you know, they're hoping this will last until the November elections and so forth. But the problem is, when you look at the most fundamental level, that's banded on the surface. And what we're really doing is we're taking a population that has an unemployment rate, if you go back to we used to calculate it, we've changed it a lot for reasons from a government's perspective over the last few decades. If you go back to the way unemployment was figured in the 1970s, real rate of employment is more like 17 to 22% instead of the 9.9% that's the artificial rate.
Right, right.
And you take an economy that's already on the floor, so to speak. We've got the highest real unemployment we've seen since the 1930s. And then you take those workers and you get a 13 to 30% price disadvantage. It's like kicking us all in the stomach. And it may look good on the surface for right now, which I'm concerned about, but in an economy is only as good as real goods and services, as the real wealth it's people producing and consuming, and I'm afraid we're severely handicapping ourselves versus the Europeans, as well as the Chinese and the Japanese, to the extent we accept a strong dollar, which means we have a very highly paid American worker, which that highly paid American worker in global terms isn't really highly paid and don't have a job.
Yeah, sure. Well, one of the things I think that many people are debating now, of course, you listen to all the commentators on TV who got it wrong. They've been getting it wrong for some time. Many of them are calling for a total annihilation of the European Union as we know it. Others are saying that it's going to survive. You know, I'm kind of curious as to your kind of macro. If you could step back and maybe just pull out your crystal ball and go out 10 years, what do you think this bodes for? Does this bode well? Is this something that the European Union can actually recover from and remain intact? The euro itself can make it. How do you view this long term from a European viewpoint?
Oh, that's some really interesting stuff, and actually it ties into some of your other themes in terms of world government and so forth. I would say the only way the euro opinion. The only likely way the euro will still be here in 10 years is if we have a much more integrated European government. Either each nation has less sovereignty than they do right now within Europe or within the world, or else the euro is going to collapse. And some various reasons for that. I think what people haven't really appreciated about the euro, and some people have talked about this from the very beginning, is that it's not a national currency. It is the currency of a monetary union. And whatever agreements nations say they're going to enter into upfront, they change over time. That's history. And we're building extraordinary pressure on the Germans and also the French.
Oh, sure.
To leave the euro at some point. And I actually wrote an article about that that's been getting quite a bit of coverage in Europe. Talking about German windfall profits from exiting the euro. And the basis of that is number one, France and Germany don't really want to leave the European Monetary Union, but they feel like they're being forced into it. Yeah, and you've got this whole thing going on about the North Europeans versus South Europeans and, you know, different lifestyles and government spending programs and so forth. But there's this pressure that's been building and building. And let's say, and the German government, as well as German companies, owe enormous sums in euro terms. And if Germany were to pull out of the euro, even if it didn't lead to a complete collapse, I think it's fair to say that we'd be looking at a 70, 80, 90% devaluation in a relatively short period of time.
Wow.
The world knows that Germany is the power behind the euro. If you had Germany, and particularly France as well, pull out, and what you're left with is Portugal and Spain and Greece and so forth, you have a differential inflation rate.
Sure.
And I think the euro is going to be dropping fast in that case. So you look at Germany that owes all this debt to the world. I think it accounts for something like 77% of their GDP right now. The Germans borrow like everyone else does. And they, the euro were to drop to 10 cents versus the new Deutschmark.
Mm-hmm.
That would mean in German terms they only owe 7.7% of the GDP.
Wow.
To the extent they're paying external bondholders.
Mm-hmm.
So what I point out in that previous article is that everyone's going to try to keep this together. But if we reach a point where it looks inevitable,
mm-hmm.
there's going to be this accelerant that comes in, and the first nation that does it gets a big windfall profit.
Sure, and nobody wants to be the last one standing, or no one wants to be the last one out of the room. So
exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. No one really wants this to fall apart, but at the mm-hmm. moment they truly accept it's inevitable, it can happen very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Daniel, we are almost out of time, and I can't let you off the line without asking you one more question. You'll have to make this brief because we're down to the last couple of minutes. But I also noticed, you know, from researching you and understanding some of the things you talk about, one of the topics you really talk about is the inflation versus the deflation debate that's been raging among economists and financial commentators over the last several years. In a speech this week in Tokyo, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke stated that U.S. inflation expectations were very stable. You know, again, the inflation-deflation debate back and forth, what are your thoughts, just real briefly, about where we're going? Do you believe that the current stability that we see, or the seeming stability that we see in prices, is going to remain? Are we heading in a deflationary phase or an inflationary phase over the next 5 to 10 years, would you say?
Oh, I wish I had 8 hours to answer that. But just very quickly, let me hit a couple of points. Total U.S. shortfall for all Social Security, Medicare, pensions, pension bailouts, all that kind of stuff, state bailouts. Some people are talking about a number of about $100 trillion.
It's unreal.
People cannot possibly relate to this, but let's look at this in a way people can relate. According to the Census Bureau, there's about 111 million U.S. households. About 11 million of those are below the poverty line. They're not going to be able to pay their share. And if you look out over the next several decades and you look at the number of boomers retiring and so forth, on average, that's going to be about another 21 million households that are over our traditional retirement age, which may no longer be the retirement age. But anyway, that leaves about 79 million, almost 80 million households. You take $100 trillion, you divide it by 80 million households, and that is $1.25 million per household.
Mm. Mm-mm-mm.
Now, I don't know about you, but I think most of the people I know are going to have trouble coming up with their $1.25 million.
Yeah, it makes it kind of silly to think that you're debt-free if you pay off the car loan and you still live in America, doesn't it?
You still have your $1.25 million. But here's the really important thing to keep in mind is that maybe the average household can't pay $1.25 million, but they could pay it if a dollar was worth 5 cents.
Sure.
Except, in getting to that, the government would have to manage the inflation indexes in such a way that you don't trigger the cost of living adjustments where pensioners would keep up with it. And when you look at those essential factors, I think you can understand an awful lot about what's going on in today's headlines.
So it almost means that inflation may be the only way out of this mess, is what you're saying.
Impossible promises have to be broken in one way or another.
Sure.
Because you can't keep them. I mean, that's just a simple fact of the matter. And you can break them in the letter of the law, in which case we essentially have a collapse of the rule of law because every level of government is breaking its promises. Or you can break them in form but not in substance. And what inflation is, it allows you to break, if you're a government, to break your promises in substance because the dollars you're paying with are hardly worth anything, but the letter of the law remains.
Mm-hmm. Well, Daniel, if people would like to learn more about your work, how can they do so?
Well, I offer a free book on this and other things, and it's available at danielammerman.com. And Ammerman is A-M-E-R-M-A-N.
Well, Daniel, it's been a great pleasure to have you on the air today, and I really appreciate your time, sir.
I sure appreciate your having me. Thanks.
Great. Thank you. Well, on the other side of this break, we're going to come right back with our commentary about the United States national debt hitting $13 trillion. We'll be right back after this break. Hi, friends. This is Jerry Robinson. I trust that you appreciate our hard-hitting Christian approach to today's economic, geopolitical, and cultural news each and every week right here on The Jerry Robinson Show. You know, every week my staff and I are hard at work to bring you the most cutting-edge insights to help you understand the times that we're living in. As you know, the Bible instructs us to understand the times, and Jesus even tells us to watch and be sober as we see the day of the Lord at hand. As we look around, most of us find our present-day situation simply breathtaking, and I believe that we are living in truly prophetic times that the Bible speaks directly about. Here at The Jerry Robinson Show, we have a great vision to see God's truth about our generation and our unique times spread across the nation through the radio airwaves. But in order for this important message to wake up our sleeping nation, we simply must have your help. In 2010, we have plans to get this program into several large radio markets right here in the U.S. and even globally. Will you stand with us in our effort to get the truth of God's Word out to America and to the world? Never before in our nation's history have hard-hitting, truth-telling, God-fearing ministries been so important to our collective future. We simply must go forth with the truth. I ask you to prayerfully consider becoming a monthly partner with our ministry with a gift of only $25 per month. You can make your pledge by calling our ministry hotline at 918-827-5764. Or you can log on to our website and donate online. Our website is www.jrmi.org. Friends, become a part of the solution and help us confront the lies of this age. Call now, 918-827-5764, or log on to our website at www.jrmi.org. Thank you, and may God richly bless you in your gift.
Welcome to the end of an empire. Surrounded by a host of political and social problems, America stands at the crossroads of a devastating economic crisis, the size and scope of which demands immediate action, while instability and debt loom over the future. America is the greatest debtor nation in history. The value of the dollar is at tremendous risk. Crippled by personal debt, local and state governments facing revenue losses, and the federal government struggling to bail out segments of the economy, many Americans are suddenly afraid and uncertain of what the future may bring. Many worry if the United States can even recover from this crisis. Will you and your family financially survive and even thrive during this turbulent time? Jerry Robinson's best-selling book, Bankruptcy of Our Nation, gives you vital insight, historical and future perspective, revealing how America got into this mess and how you can make informed decisions to weather this economic crisis. Don't rely on the government to secure your future. Empower yourself with sound economic strategies, solutions, and godly principles today. Get the best-selling Bankruptcy of Our Nation at a special price, only $13.99, with free shipping. Call the JRMI hotline at 918-827-5764 or log on to www.jrmi.org and order online. Supplies are limited, so order today.
Welcome back to the Jerry Robinson Show. I'm your host, Jerry Robinson, on the web at www.jrmi.org. So glad to have you here on the show. As we move into our next segment on the topic of the United States national debt. You know, this week, Jay, I was reading that the national debt, and really it doesn't mean anything. I mean, we just see numbers that move, and there's a United States national debt clock that you can watch that we actually have a link to on our website. If you just go to jrmi.org and click on the national debt clock, and these are everywhere on the internet, but there's one in particular that we really like, and we've linked to it on our website, and it just crossed $13 trillion this week. $13 trillion, our national debt. And, you know, it makes me think about how this nation has evolved over time. Back in 1980, do you know what the national debt was back in 1980?
$5 trillion?
$5 trillion? No, you would think that, you know, things would not have happened the way they have. It was not even $1 trillion back in 1980.
Less than $1 trillion 30 years ago.
Less than $1 trillion 30 years ago. It stood at $900 billion in 1980. Now, we move forward three short decades later, we are standing at $13 trillion. At the current rate of how this is going, we're going to reach $14 trillion in 8 months. We're going to reach it in 8 months. So before this year is over, well, I guess, no, it would be just in the very beginning of 2011, wouldn't it? We're actually going to hit $14 trillion. We'll reach $15 trillion in another 7 months after that.
So
so the process is accelerating rapidly.
Absolutely. By the end of 2011, we are estimating that we could reach $15.5 trillion of national debt. And what's so difficult about it is, as our last guest pointed out, that when you take this and you break it down per citizen, or even worse, when you break it down per taxpayer, you know, we find that it's very, very unsustainable. And then you consider the fact that where all this money actually has interest attached to it. So it's growing by the interest daily.
Yeah, you have it there in your book, and I can't remember the exact numbers, but the actual interest on the debt daily is, you know, just astronomical.
It's outrageous. The interest is in the billions per day. I'll give you an example. Back in 2006, the interest for the entire national debt was $406 billion. So we owed $406 billion in fiscal year 2006 just for the interest on the national debt. In the book, Bankruptcy of Our Nation, we actually have a chart that breaks this down, and we show how amazing and different that is when you compare it to other things that we had that fiscal year, like the Department of Labor. You know, to run the entire Department of Labor throughout the entire fiscal year of 2006 cost $11.5 billion. The NASA space program in 2006 cost a paltry $16.5 billion. The Department of Energy, $23 billion. The Department of Homeland Security, $34 billion. The Department of Health and Human Services, one of the largest, $67 billion. You add up all the departments and equaled less than the interest on the national debt.
So if we could just get rid of the interest on the national debt, we would actually probably be able to afford the programs that we have. We'd probably be able to afford everything that we have if we could just get rid of the interest payment on the national debt.
Perhaps, and that's certainly something to consider. And as we see how things are progressing, we see how dismal it really is and how little our politicians are doing anything to resolve these matters. I mean, from 1980 to 1986, the national debt did in 6 short years what it had taken nearly 200 years to do the first time. It increased by $1 trillion. So from 1791 all the way to 1980, we had accumulated almost $1 trillion of debt. But from 1980 to 1986, we increased by another trillion. So in 6 short years, we did what it took our country 200 years to do. From 86 to 1990, we did it again. We added another trillion. And in the 90s, it continued on. From 90 to 92, another trillion. From 92 to 96, another trillion. From 96 to 2002, another trillion. And then when we got into the 2000s, it was just out of control. 2002 to 2004, another trillion was added. 2004 to 2006, another trillion. 2006 to 2007, another trillion. So now it's almost to where we're doing it in less than 1 year. We're adding another trillion to our national debt.
200 years to 6 years to 4 years to 2 years, and then it stayed kind of steady at the 2 years rate. And now, like you said, 8 months, 7 months, 6 months. Now, if it keeps going at that rate, we're going to be adding $1 trillion a month before long.
Absolutely. And when you think about it, what about the interest on all that? That's obviously just the principal.
Well, that's what it gets up to, that $428 billion a year.
And the question comes, what have our politicians done to prevent our national debt from spinning out of control? I mean, what are they actually doing? How are they? What they're trying to do now is they're trying to get another $300 billion passed before Memorial Day for all the different spending bills that they want to get done.
So they can go ahead and increase the debt some more.
So it's just...
just brilliant. Just absolutely brilliant.
It's mind-blowing. It's mind-blowing.
I have this little picture on my phone that says stress relief, and it says in the middle of it, bang head here. That's kind of how I feel about the national debt.
Well,
bang head here.
Very little is being done. And so obviously as we look out and we see the scenario, many people understand the dangers of debt. I mean, they obviously want to be out of debt. Nobody wants to have a lot of debt, personal debt. However, when they think of the government debt, they see this $13 trillion. I think many people think that Obama has like an American Express card that he just charges and it goes to that, or he dips into the big Fort Knox and he pays all these things. No, this is the people's money. You know, we owe this money, and it's going to be worse and worse and worse. And these are just the things on the balance sheet. When you go to the unfunded liabilities, as Daniel Lamberman had just mentioned, we're talking, you know, the number was $60 trillion. It keeps moving up. I see different numbers. The new one I'm seeing a lot is $108 trillion dollars. 108.
I hadn't seen that one. The largest I had seen was 78. Mm-hmm. So, wow, it's skyrocketing.
Well, it all depends what you add. But, I mean, we're adding in now many different things, and we're seeing all the unfunded obligations that are not on the balance sheet.
If we ran our business and didn't put our unfunded obligations on our balance sheet, we'd be sharing a jail cell with old Bernie Madoff.
There's no doubt about it. No doubt about it. So, you know, we're watching all this and we're seeing what happens. And, of course, this $13 trillion, just another nail in the coffin, kind of helping us understand how fast and how drastic our out-of-control spending and our out-of-control politics, our out-of-control fiscal policies and monetary policies have taken us to a place at the edge of the cliff. And it's just going to be, like we've mentioned, a long downward trend.
Well, we're going to fall off the edge of the cliff, but this is not one of those straight cliffs. This is one of those ones that's kind of angled. So we're going to hit a rock here, and we're going to bounce off this one. And ooh, ow,
sure.
Oh, ow, all the way down
that's,
the hill.
That's a rough way to go. That's a rough way to go. Well, on the other side of this break, we're going to come back, and we're going to talk about our two standard segments, the Road to the One World Currency and your question of the week. You are listening to The Jerry Robinson Show on the web at www.jrmi.org.
Are you getting the word out about your business? Do you pay too much for advertising on traditional media? In today's economic climate, businesses must promote themselves more than ever before. The Truth and Focus Radio Network can help. Email us today at radio@truthandfocus.org for great rates on internet radio and web page ads. Again, the email is radio@truthandfocus.org.
Hi friends, this is Jerry Robinson from the Jerry Robinson Radio Show. Are you looking for a trusted financial advisor who shares your same spiritual beliefs and values? You know, each month here at our organization, we receive numerous requests for biblically based financial planning advice and counsel. And in response, we've created something known as the Christian Financial Advisor Network. Now, this is simply an organization of Christian financial planners and advisors who provide biblically based financial planning services to clients nationwide. We have now expanded our advising to 27 different states across the country. If you're interested in learning more about the Christian Financial Advisor Network to find a Christian financial advisor for yourself and your family, contact us at makersgroupfinancial.com. Simply go to our website, fill out the form, and we will be back in touch with you within 48 hours. makersgroupfinancial.com. Welcome back to the Jerry Robinson Show. I'm your host, Jerry Robinson, founder and director of JRMI and the chief economic strategist at Makers Group Financial on the web at www.makersgroupfinancial.com. Well, with this week's Road to the One World Currency, to get us kicked off, I'll hand things over to Jay. Thanks, Jay.
All right. Welcome to the Road to the One World Currency. This week, the road takes us to England for this article from thetelegraph.uk. The EU proposes bank tax to end unacceptable taxpayer bailouts. Banks must face new taxes to avoid repeating the unacceptable bailouts of failed banks that cost taxpayers billions, the European Union's chief financial regulator warned. European banks may face taxes on the size of their balance sheets, on how much they owe other institutions, or on how much profit they make. Michael Barnier, the EU's Financial Services Commissioner, said on Wednesday, the cash raise would be used to pay for future bailouts. It is not acceptable that taxpayers should continue to bear the heavy cost of rescuing the banking sector, Mr. Barnier said. They should not be in the front line. I believe in the polluter pays principle. Now, Jerry, we've been watching this story slowly unfold over the last few weeks. Do you think this tax will be implemented worldwide, or will nations do it individually? And in the long run, does it even matter which way it's implemented?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, this is something that we're obviously noticing as the global financial crisis begins to draw financial interests together. It begins to bring the banking system together. It's an excuse, obviously, to bring more regulation to the banking industry, which obviously what the elitists have always wanted from the very beginning, to get control over all of the banks in one single place. The banks obviously have their own interests. They already feel overregulated. So this obviously seems like just another tax to the banks. It seems unfair. The EU is attempting to build a new financial safeguards to protect its interests, you know, something that it's calling the crisis management framework that it keeps referring to. Now, bringing the banking industry closer together brings us one step closer to a globally integrated financial system, which is obviously where we believe that we're heading, that road to the one world currency, which eventually will pave the way to a single global financial system, a single global monetary union, so to speak, and a single global currency. So this obviously brings all that into closer view for us. But there's another side to this that I want to bring up as well, and that is the idea of moral hazard. You know, it becomes difficult because the EU really, it finds itself in a kind of a quandary, because on one hand, taking the taxpayers' money to bail out the financial institutions is obviously not a very good idea.
Yeah, I mean, that's not very fair.
That's obviously socialist, right? You know, and so it's not a very good thing to do, to bail out these financial institutions. However, the alternative here to have a bank tax that allows all the banks to put money into a kitty or put money into the pool, and then that money can be used to bail out banks in the event of a financial crisis. Well, what this does is it creates something in economics known as a moral hazard, and that is that if the banks know that the money's there, then it encourages more risky practices to take place, because they know that if they get busted or they get caught, well, they can just go pull money out of the kitty. And so then all the banks become suspicious of each other and say, now, are they doing this? Are they doing things to get money out of the pool? Because obviously, if you put money in, you want to get money back out.
Well, it basically allows for a few bad apples to go out there and, you know, risk everything all the time, and with no real risk involved, because, hey, we're just going to get bailed out, while those who are being responsible, basically, they get cheated because they have to go pay for somebody else's irresponsibility.
Sure.
It's just as socialist and just as wrong as the taxpayers bailing them out.
It's almost the lesser of two evils that you have to choose from here, because either way, you're not going to slow down the risky practices that many of these financial institutions are.
There is a third option. It's called, there's no such thing as too big to fail.
Well, you
let them fall off the cliff, go ahead with a merciful death, and we can start over.
That's exactly what free market capitalism is all about. It's what it's always been about. We're not in that era anymore, Jay. We've moved into a new era where all of a sudden every institution that is too big to fail has to be bailed out somehow. It's unreal. It's a very, very sad place we find ourselves.
You know, it's obviously that road to that one world currency and one world government. And unless we back it off, we're going to be flying into that real quick.
Yep. Well, we'll move on to our question of the week, Jay.
All right, now it's time for the question of the week, and this one comes from James K. of Savannah, Georgia. It says here, I am a 34-year-old self-employed male, and I've been approached by my financial advisor about obtaining disability insurance. Do you think that disability insurance is a good thing, or is it a ripoff?
That's a good question, James. Here's the way we view insurance in our organization. Number one, there are no do-overs with insurance. Okay, here's the way we look at it. If you put money into your 401k and the market tanks 30%, can you recover? Sure, you can recover, especially if you're 34 years old. You can handle that. If you put money into gold and silver and then it tanks, can you recover? Sure. You start a business and it fails, can you recover? Sure. You don't buy disability insurance and then you get disabled. Can you recover from that? No. You die without life insurance. Can you recover from that? No. You get in a massive wreck and don't have enough auto insurance. Can you recover from that? Usually not. I mean, it's pretty devastating. So in insurance, there are no do-overs. And most people's greatest asset that they have, Jay, I would say probably the greatest asset that you have and that I have is our ability to produce income.
Absolutely.
I mean, let's say that James here. I don't know how much money James makes per year, but let's just assume he makes $50,000. He's 34 years old. He's making $50,000 a year. He's going to work until he's 65, right? That magic year. That's about 31 years. Okay, times 50,000 times 30, that's about $1.5 million. I don't think James, maybe James has $1.5 million laying around somewhere, but if he doesn't, then that is his greatest asset. That's a $1.5 million golden goose that's going to produce for him.
Exactly.
And he has to protect that. And how can he possibly protect that asset? I mean, if you had a $1.5 million laying around, you'd probably want to protect it somehow. Well, the way you protect your greatest asset, your income-producing ability, is to get disability insurance, because disabilities obviously prevent you from being able to work, which obviously is how you produce income. It's interesting because many years ago there were over 500 disability insurance companies. That number dropped to less than 400 in 1990. In 2003, the number dropped even more, down to just 26 disability insurance companies.
From 500 companies down to 26?
Down to 26.
That seems to be a pretty narrow space there.
Well, according to a 2004 disability status report by Cornell University, only 27% of American income earners actually had disability insurance. And there was a commissioner's disability table put out in 1998 that showed that nearly 1 in 7 people will miss more than 5 years of work due to a disability. That's roughly 50% of all mortgage foreclosures, and nearly 20% of personal bankruptcies in 2001 were caused by disabilities. So the question arises, and I think, James, this would be the question to ask, how would you support yourself if you couldn't work due to a disability? Who would pay bills for you and pay your rent or pay your mortgage if you're laid up on the couch for 6 months and you can't work? And that's exactly what disability income insurance does. It steps in and it provides that income for you, either in a short-term basis or a long-term basis. That's the difference, short-term disability and long-term disability. I would say to you that if you have short-term or long-term disability benefits at work, I would run, not walk, to my HR department and sign up for those. They're normally $3 or $4 or $5 per paycheck, sometimes maybe even 10 or 12. And it is the best single thing that you can do. And then after you figure out how much of the benefit they're going to provide to you, you could even talk to your financial advisor about getting more. But long-term disability and short-term disability are very different. Obviously, we don't have time to get into right. all that. But the policy, typically the premiums that you're going to pay are usually about 1% to 4% of your annual income. So if you're earning $50,000 per year, it'd be somewhere between 1% and 4% per year, basically, to protect that. And that's not very much to pay to protect that $50,000 a year income that you're getting. One more thing I would probably mention is, when you're looking at a disability insurance policy, notice the difference between what they call own occupation versus any occupation. And let me give you a classic example. If a doctor, for example, buys disability insurance, and then he hurts his hand permanently. Maybe his hand's paralyzed and therefore he can't operate anymore and he's unable to continue his work. And he has a disability policy that is any occupation. Well, that means that the disability will not pay any kind of benefits if he can go get any job. So if he can go work at a McDonald's and use his left hand on the register button, that means that he's out of luck. He's going to have to go get that job.
So the own occupation is a higher level, better.
The own occupation policy basically means that he could go out and do any other job besides his own and still get the disability policy. So maybe he can't operate anymore, but he can go teach, right? Well, he can go teach and still get the disability check. So I think the own occupation disability policy by far is worth the little extra added than the any occupation disability policy.
I learn something new every time we do this show.
And then, of course, the question always comes to, how much should I buy, right? Well, think about how much you would want if you needed it, right? Obviously, I think if any of us could if we became disabled and we could go back to that table and sitting down with the financial advisor, how much will we want? Will we want the minimum or will we want the maximum? If you're going to want the maximum, then find a way to make that happen. So obviously, there's other things we can talk about inflation riders, future increase options, all this, but you can discuss that with your financial advisor. But I would say to you that, yes, disability insurance is not something that's a ripoff. It is something that you should consider, and you can certainly talk to your financial advisor about disability insurance. I think it's a great idea. All right. Well, Jay, great to have you this week.
Oh, yeah. It's been a great week here. And, folks, if you have a question you would like Jerry to answer on the air, please send your questions to questions@jrmi.org.
Well, Thank you so much for tuning into the Jerry Robinson Show. It's been a great pleasure having you here. What a great interview we have with Daniel Ammerman. Be sure to check him out on online at danielammerman.com. Also, feel free to go to our website at jrmi.org and check out that U.S. debt clock we've been talking about.
Absolutely.
And we look forward to seeing you right here, the same place, the same time next week. The Jerry Robinson Show on the web at www.jrmi.org. Don't forget to seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and everything that you ever need will be given to you.
Amen.
Robinson Show do not necessarily represent the views of Jerry Robinson Ministries International Incorporated and Makers Group Financial LLC. Even though these are proven strategies, Jerry Robinson is not a financial advisor and his guests are not legal or tax advisors. You should always consult a trained financial advisor and/or tax advisor before making any financial decisions.